So the Russian Revolution was definitely the most inspiring and important collective act in human history. And so it can seem counterintuitive then that we're having a talk which focuses on the role of one individual in that revolution. But I don't think there is a contradiction, because the Marxist method is all about collective action, yes, but also individual responsibility and understanding the role that individuals can play as part of collective movements. And sometimes, at some point in history, some individuals symbolise and reflect and are part of a whole wave of social transformation, and their experience kind of embodies that. And you can think of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement for another example. So the Russian Revolution was an event which inspired the most democratic transformation of society ever seen, but it was a thoroughly collective event. But the role of Trotsky, both before, during and after the revolution, is something also worth studying for today, both because he represents the high point of the working class struggle in history, but he also represents a thoughtful and uniquely insightful historian whose writings on the Russian Revolution have never been matched or replicated. And also he's somebody who fought to his dying breath, actually, Stalinism and the monstrosity that emerged, unfortunately, out of the defeat of the Russian Revolution. And the final decades of his life actually kept alive the true revolutionary spirit of our movement. And so I think for all these reasons, he's worth talking about as part of the revolution. Okay, so Leon Trotsky, he grew up in a rural middle-class Jewish family in Russia. And the Russia he grew up in was a very rural peasant society made up of overwhelmingly of small farmers trying to eke off a living on small patches of barren land. Meanwhile, you had very small numbers of landowners who controlled the vast majority of the most fertile territory. He started his political life in 1896 when he moved to a university town in the Ukraine. Now, he went there to study maths, but he pretty quickly ditched that to form a union among factory workers, which I think was a very wise career decision for him, and I recommend others follow in his path. He was recruited to Marxism by Alexandra Sokolovskaya, and in his biography, Trotsky talks about how much fun he had teasing her, because she was a materialist and he was initially an anarchist. She was a Marxist, had a perspective on social change, which was patient and strategic, and he was just like a florid kind of radical individualist. But he was eventually recruited by her, and the tables were turned. Now, in what was typical for underground socialists at the time, Trotsky only spent a few months organising in the real world before being captured by the secret police, sent to jail and tortured. And at this point, he was only 19 years old. And he spent 2 years in a brutal Tsarist prison before being sent to Siberia with his family for 4 years. And it was from this prison where he gained the name Trotsky, which was the names of one of his guards. And from Siberia, he began correspondence with a small socialist newspaper based in London, edited by Vladimir Lenin. And after a while of these, you know, love letters, he eventually decided to escape Siberia, probably because it was pretty fucking cold. And he moved to London. And as soon as he got there, he began helping Lenin edit this newspaper alongside the veterans of the socialist movement of the time. And by the time this all was taking place, it was 1904. And in the intervening years, Russia's economy had been expanding as the country had been desperately trying to catch up with its rivals in Central, Western Europe and Japan. And the Tsar, the dictatorship which Russia was, had spent a lot of money investing in modern manufacturing capacity to build a military. And this had created, in turn, thousands of urban working-class people, tens of thousands and millions, in fact. And these people were concentrated in huge factories in very dense suburban areas. And this newly formed working class had a big impact immediately. There was a massive strike wave at the start of the 20th century in Russia. And so radical was the mood in the cities, especially in Petrograd, that the police actually decided to set up a fake union in order to kind of channel people's discontent into a safe and controllable operation. And that turned out to be a big mistake. But at the beginning, it didn't seem like it would be, because they put in charge this priest, Father Gapon, who was genuinely an extremely moderate and conservative guy. But after the government initiated a war with Japan, a war which they began losing pathetically immediately, we had thousands of people dying, the country going into economic crisis, the priest was so horrified by the poverty produced by this war and the horrors of it that he organised a protest march to the palace of the Tsar, you know, with genuine intentions of petitioning the Tsar for some improvements, but the monarchy responded with a massacre. and thus began the 1905 revolution. This was the greatest revolution in history to that time. It forced the Tsar to grant the first vaguely democratic body in Russia's history, the Duma. It saw nationally oppressed minorities across the country rise up and demand some freedom. And most importantly of all, it saw the birth of workers' councils in their modern form for the first time. These were democratically elected councils, elected by mass meetings of various workplaces, and who would then discuss what they wanted to do and implement that. And so as you can see, this revolution was quite an amazing thing for its time. And probably one of the most radical things that symbolises the profundity of this process was the fact that these councils elected Trotsky to be the president of the Soviet in Petrograd. And why is this amazing? It's because Russia was an intensely racist society, much like Australia today, but Jews were the main target at this time in Russia. And Trotsky was, of course, a Jew. But every time in Russian history there was a social tension, there was, you know, poverty, you know, some sort of social breakdown, the government would whip up anti-Semitism as a way of scapegoating, much like we see with refugees in Australia today. So the fact that Trotsky was elected to be president of the Petrograd Soviet is like a black man being elected the president of the Alabama protest movement or something in the 1940s. It's incredible. It was shocking at the time. But why could it happen? It could happen because Trotsky was an intensely intelligent, charismatic and entertaining person. But it also happened because the revolution was so profoundly radical that people could see that all the old ways of doing politics were unacceptable and that oppression, racism, sexism, exploitation, all of that had to be cast aside for the chance of changing the world. But unfortunately, in 1905, the monarchy still had a sufficient base in the army and in the peasantry to hold on. And so by 1906, the whole thing was pushed back and crushed, really. Hundreds were killed and thousands were imprisoned. The parliament that was granted during the revolution was totally stripped back, and all the leaders were pretty much sent to jail. And Trotsky was, of course, one of them. He was charged with insurrection and sentenced to life in Siberia. And he wrote a book while in Siberia, or actually shortly after he left Siberia, where he documents what it was like to be there in the piercing cold. But the thing about this this time was, which is kind of nice compared to what we face today, is they were just like transporting these people, in trains. And then at one point, Trotsky decided it was time to escape. And so he pretended to be sick, was sent to hospital, and jumped out the window and got on a dog sled and went across the Siberian tundra. And that was that, you know, and he found himself in London. You can't do that these days, unfortunately. The years after the revolution were very hard for Trotsky and his comrades because they'd helped to lead the greatest revolutionary struggle in the world to this time. They'd been leaders of general strikes, of insurrections. They fought on the barricades, and they, you know, their speeches were heard by tens of thousands of people. But now the revolution was over, and they were exiled in London, in small communities of people, squabbling among the poverty of exile life, and discussing and debating details of a future revolution that no one was sure was ever going to come. And so in this condition of kind of demoralisation and defeat, the left disintegrated, and many quite important figures decided to give up and pursue personal advancement, turn to religion, or simply drank themselves into oblivion. And Trotsky was one of the small number of people who held their nerve during this difficult time, and together with a small group of people put out a socialist newspaper, which they called Pravda, or Truth. And their goal through this newspaper was to link up radicals and revolutionaries across the Russian Empire and to begin to recalibrate and recohere a socialist movement. But one obvious question is, how do a small group of intellectuals in London communicate with the Russian working class spread across like half a continent? Today, it'd be straightforward. You hop on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and that would be that. In those days, that wasn't an option. So what they had to do was recruit activists, and they themselves were these activists, who would risk their lives and freedom by crossing borders, carrying copies of these newspapers in false-bottomed suitcases, sewn into their jackets, into their dresses and skirts, this kind of thing. And this is how thousands of newspapers were smuggled into the country. And many of these activists would be arrested very quickly. The average time out of prison was about 3 months. So you would spend way more time in prison than you would organising. But they had thousands of people who were prepared to do this for year after year in order to build the left. And that's what they did. And so over time, you have a socialist movement rebuilt in Russia over years. And as the socialist movement grew, the Russian economy was beginning to revive after the kind of the crisis of 1905-06. And so, again, you had a strike wave. And many people were thinking that 1913, 1914 was going to be the year of the Russian Revolution Mark II. But World War II changed things. Initially, there was quite a lot of support for the war in Russia. But as the body count grew and the conditions became more extreme, things turned. Now, Trotsky, like the Bolshevik Party, which he would later join, was totally against the war from day one. Now, this is important because World War I was the most barbaric thing in history. This was a war where people were using, you know, feudal tactics against machine guns. So you'd have people line up in straight lines and walk slowly towards rows of machine guns and just be slaughtered. And when that seemed to... people realised that wasn't a good idea, they just bunkered into trenches and did the same thing, but periodically returning to safety. Trotsky was one of the few people to oppose the war. All the heroes of bourgeois society pretty much supported it. Mahatma Gandhi supported World War I. The anarchist Kropotkin supported World War I. Winston Churchill, the Labour Party at the time in Australia. Everyone supported this war. It was only really the revolutionary left who stood firm against it. And that's something that we should never forget. But as time went on, the Russian people came to see that this war offered them nothing. Millions were dead. Starvation was everywhere. War veterans walked the streets, homeless, looking for food to survive. And importantly and instructively enough, all of this frustration exploded on International Women's Day in 1917, which began as a strike of textile workers leading the way, demanding cheaper bread and higher wages, but ended up destroying the most oppressive and long-lasting dynasty in human history. Again, you have scenes of solidarity everywhere. Women started the revolution, men backed them up. Jews, Ukrainians, Muslims, every group of the Russian Empire got on board the protest movement and the revolution. And again, they set up councils to decide the future of the process, not just in Petrograd and Moscow, but across the whole country this time. And this time, due to the massively expanded nature of World War I compared to the war with Japan, the army was no longer sympathetic to the monarchy. They were no longer prepared to fight and die for this disgusting regime. This time, the peasantry, who'd previously been a bastion of conservatism, were pissed off by the extreme extraction of grain to fight that war. And this time, the workers could not be so easily crushed because their numbers had grown and spread across the country due to the war economy. And so despite the fact they were still a minority, they were much more powerful and better placed minority to lead uprisings across the empire. And so the Tsar fell just 5 days into February Revolution. But the immediate question that comes up after such an event, and we've seen it in Sudan and Algeria and Egypt and a whole range of countries more recently, you get rid of the pinnacle of a disgusting regime. But what comes next? What kind of society do you want to build? For the wealthy and the middle classes, they wanted things to stay exactly the same, but with the illusion of a parliamentary democracy. And people here have experienced parliamentary democracy, and you can understand why that wasn't necessarily the most inspiring thing for the population of Russia. For the centre-left, the kind of Labour Party equivalent of the Russian experience, they had a bit more radical idea. They thought Russia should change fundamentally more than that. They thought there should be more taxes on the rich, more of a welfare state. They eventually came on board with the 8-hour day. Maybe they thought peasants should have a bit more land than they currently did. And maybe they thought that soldiers should have slightly more rights in the trenches. But essentially they agreed that capitalism should stay in place as well. So then there was the Bolsheviks, who after a few weeks of debate and discussion internally came to the correct position that the revolution had begun and that they should carry it forward as far as possible to try and resolve the fundamental problems of Russian society. That was capitalism. And Trotsky totally agreed with the Bolshevik Party and the future of the revolution. In fact, he'd been arguing for the strategy the Bolsheviks adopted in 1917 years earlier. He called it the theory of permanent revolution. Permanent because you start with getting rid of a dictator, but you end by overthrowing capitalism, first in the country, then internationally. So the revolution doesn't stop, essentially. This was an important argument because the revolution initially seemed to unite the whole population in this process of social transformation. But actually, very quickly after February, it became apparent that the country was still in crisis. There was no food, the war continued, people were still dying, there was mutinies in the army, peasant rebellions, the military was being slaughtered, and the Germans were coming within striking distance of Petrograd. And so the population was radicalized and ready to take action. And by this point, Trotsky had joined the Bolshevik Party. This is late 1917 we're talking. And together they campaigned across the country in nationwide elections to workers' councils on the basis of an immediate end to the war, which was, you know, one of the main demands of the revolution in this time. A workers' control over industry, which they argued was the only way of resolving the fundamental problem of industrial collapse and sabotage. And for peasant control over the land, which was to take all the land owned by a small number of extremely wealthy landlords and distribute it among the poor. And all of these demands could only be met, they argued, by overthrowing the provisional government, the capitalist government that had been installed after the February Revolution, to abolish the army, abolish the police, and set up a horizontal democratic structure of workers' councils across the country in its place. And they got a massive majority of support in these elections in the latter half of the year. And so in October, they carried out their policy and overthrew the unelected and unsupported provisional government. And this was a remarkably uneventful affair. Even historians who don't support the revolution comment on how little was involved in overthrowing this government. And the reason that is because no one actually really supported it by the time of October. And the October Revolution is really a high point of human history, to this day, I would argue. It did all the things that were kind of prefigured in 1905, but took them to the next step. So last time you had ethnic and national minorities rising up. This time they achieved independence in a whole bunch of places. Last time, workers and peasants fought for their rights. This time, they began to take control over the economy directly themselves. The first decision made by these councils was to end Russia's involvement in World War I, the most murderous event in history to that time. Now, this is really important because the end of World War I is not really talked about very often. Everyone knows how it started. There was a duke killed in Serbia, but no one really knows how it ended. We just somehow jumped to the Treaty of Versailles. But the reason it ended is because there was a revolution in Russia, the workers ended Russia's involvement in the war, then there was a revolution in Germany a year later, which made the whole thing untenable, and that was that. But that's obviously not in the interest of the historians to talk about. But the October Revolution began the process that ended World War I. It was the only thing that did it. On a daily life, women's lives were transformed. Abortion was made legal and free. Communal kitchens began to be set up in order to take away the unpaid labour, the drudgery of that kind of work that so many people have to do, unappreciated. Gay marriage was allowed. It was decriminalised. And serious and sensitive research into gender transitions was undertaken in a whole bunch of clinics. And you've got to imagine, this is in the context of a civil war, of an extreme impoverished country, but they decided to prioritise things like this because they had a view of human liberation. And the list goes on. So you can imagine the euphoria and delight of the population of Russia as society was being changed for the better. And this revolution was the most unbelievable experiment in democracy and human liberation that history has seen and still has seen to this time. But unfortunately, the joy of this process was short-lived because from day one, the revolution was in mortal danger. Threatened with annihilation by the capitalists, by military officers, and by citizens of the Russian equivalent of the North Shore, the south bank of Melbourne. These people, the socialists are often accused of being violent and bloodthirsty. What happened with these people is after the revolution, they were brought into the offices of the Bolshevik Party and said, look, we don't want to imprison you. We want you to go free. You're not worth our time. We just sign a contract, please, that you won't organise a civil war against us. You'll obey the new laws of the new government. And they all signed, went away, and then proceeded to start a civil war. And so they organised a white army to try and overthrow the government and go back to how things were. And they were supported by, I think it's 15 countries invaded Russia, most of whom had been fighting each other, but suddenly united when they realised there was something really different going on. We can all fight over territory, but we can all agree that socialism is something that a threat that unites us all. So in this context, Trotsky was asked to lead the Red Army in order to resist this disgusting kind of civil war. And after 3 years, against all odds, the Red Army won. And there's a lot of bullshit said about the civil war, but there's this one quote I think you need to understand and hear in order to know what it was really about. So this is from Major General William Graves. He's the commander of the American forces in Siberia, i.e. an occupying force supporting the White Army. And he said, he wrote to his superiors, I consider myself well on the side of safety when I say that the anti-Bolsheviks killed 100 people in eastern Siberia to every one killed by the Bolsheviks. That's an American general doing the killing. Everywhere the whites won, Jews and trade unionists were slaughtered in the streets. Democratic institutions were abolished and dictatorship reinstalled. And this is one of the main reasons why the Red Army could win, because as soon as you had an area controlled by the White Army, they would try and install land, you know, reinstall the landlords, take back the land, put the peasants back in chains, and so people would rise up against them and decide to back the Red Army. And so eventually they won, but while the victory was won by this heroic and incredible, largely volunteer army, it came at a great cost. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed in the process. The economy of Russia was destroyed. The democratic structures of revolutions, based on mass participation in democratic discussion and decision-making, was pretty much left in tatters. And again, symbolizing all this was Lenin and his personal story, which he suffered two attempted assassinations as part of the Civil War, and he died in 1924. And his death really marks the beginning of a new phase of the revolution and a new phase of Trotsky's life, and probably his most important phase. He argued it was his most important phase. And that was Trotsky's battle against Stalin and the destruction of the Russian Revolution. Now, Stalinism and the USSR, which he built, with all its gulags, wars, oppression, secret police, is often presented as the logical outcome of the Russian Revolution. But the truth is, it was a total negation of the Russian Revolution. Stalin spent years in mortal combat with the leading lights of the October Revolution, sending thousands of them to jail, to Siberia, and to death. And Trotsky's story is important because he fought back in the most systematic and sustained way against Stalin's distortions and lies. And so in the mid-20s, Trotsky refused to give up on international revolution and argued that any attempt to do so would mean becoming more and more like the capitalist class and the capitalist states that they sought to challenge. And he was right. So by 1928, following the theory of socialism in one country, Russia had become a state capitalist country, extremely similar to all the other oppressive countries around the world. In the 1930s, Trotsky argued for a united front against fascism, which was a collaboration of the left to stop the deadly risk of Hitler in Germany. Meanwhile, Stalin signed a pact with Hitler, a peace treaty, which allowed Hitler to go to war, and we know what happened next. And there were many different specific arguments and debates through these years. I can't go through them all. But the most important thing was that Trotsky kept these ideas alive of genuine Marxism and socialism from below. The idea that working class people are key to social transformation, not one-party dictatorships, whether they call themselves communist or otherwise. The idea that Marxism is at its heart a democratic theory, not one based on authoritarian leaders doing what's best for the rest of us. And the idea that Russia, as it was under Stalin, had nothing to do with socialism. Now, Trotsky was eventually murdered with an ice pick in 1941, only after seeing all but one of his children killed by Stalin's assassins. This was an extremely high price to pay. He spent years travelling from country to country trying to escape the assassins. Many bourgeois governments refused to allow him into their countries because they feared that he would stir up resistance in those places. But just before he died, he wrote in a testament just a few days before he was assassinated, he wrote a testament where he made clear he regretted none of his policies and actions. And I'll quote that, because it's a really moving piece. He says, "For 43 years of my conscious life, I have remained a revolutionist. For 42 of them, I have fought under the banner of Marxism. If I had to begin all over again, I would, of course, try to avoid this or that mistake, but the main course of my life would remain unchanged. My faith in the communist future of mankind is no less ardent. Indeed, it is firmer today than it was in the days of my youth." Natasha has just come up to the window from the courtyard and opened it wider so that the air may enter more freely into my room. I can see the bright green strip of grass beneath the wall and the clear blue sky above it, and sunlight everywhere. Life is beautiful. Let the future generations cleanse it of all evil, oppression, and violence, and enjoy it to the full. Now, these are the writings of someone who dedicated their life to social change and someone who I think we should seek to emulate in our commitment, if not necessarily in our opportunity to rise to the heights that he did. The Russian Revolution and its aftermath are crucial events for the left to grapple with to this day. They give us an insight into what a different kind of world could look like. A world free of oppression, where women are treated as equals, where democracy actually means something, where class hierarchies can be abolished. And this is important for us living in a world of Trumps, of Duttons, of endless war and aching poverty. We need something better to look forward to in the future and to guide our struggles in the here and now. But we also need a strategy that can actually win. And though there have been many revolutions in the modern era, the Russian Revolution goes the furthest in suggesting what that might be. They show how the working class is crucial to achieving all the changes that we want to see, that people like us can make an enormous difference if we work together and collaborate. It makes the case for workers' power, that the working class in the saddle of society can liberate not just themselves, but all of us, and we can do so together. This is something that we can always use in our day-to-day struggles. Our orientation to the working class as being the agent of change guides so much about what we do as socialists. It guides the arguments we make in every single movement. We're always arguing for collective action, for mass action, for involving trade unions, rank-and-file networks. Bring your workmates, bring your classmates to every protest. Don't just come along as a participant, become an organiser. Because working class people becoming organisers is how revolutions can succeed. And so I think that learning from the revolution and from Trotsky's life has its relevance both in terms of understanding a long-term view of social change, but also in terms of developing a profound personal commitment to changing the world today. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, there's a really great documentary that I think Matt was alluding to, which is called From Tsar to Lenin. And I think it's on YouTube. It's really good. It's worth watching. It's just all footage from the Times with a funny narration over the top. You're a nice American man. The question. So what is a leader? I think there's a lot of mystification about leadership. A leader is someone who speaks up. That's what a leader is, someone who speaks up. And then better leaders are better at speaking up because they've done it for longer and have got more weighty understanding of what they're trying to speak up about under their belt, so that when they speak up, they're more compelling. In revolutionary processes, there's leaders. Well, in all times, there's always leaders all the time, everywhere. So whether they're right-wing leaders, centrist leaders, left-wing leaders, union leaders, classroom leaders, revolutionary leaders, they all exist. The question is, whose leadership is taken more seriously? Who's more compelling? Who wins the argument? And that matters today. That matters when you're in your classroom, at school, or at work, trying to convince your colleagues to join the union or join a protest. You want to be more effective than the fucker who's saying, oh, protesting, you know, who would do that? So that's leadership, and you want to be better than that. It matters much more in revolutions, because in revolutions, everything's life or death. Once you start a revolution, as DT said very accurately, it's not a joke. Everything becomes into play, including your life and the life of people you love and care about. So being a good and competent leader is an important thing to try and achieve. And as a socialist organisation, as a movement, we want every single member of our movement to be the best leader they can possibly be, so that we can all participate in a movement that can change the world. In terms of leadership and then in Russian Revolution, there were three elections in 1917. Three elections in the Soviets in the space of between February and October. So what's that? 8 months. So that is the kind of fluid democratic discussion and process that we're talking about when we're talking about revolutionary democracy. The first time the Bolsheviks were a small minority. The second time they were still a minority, but less so. The third time they were a very strong majority. And so that is a result of an interventionist leadership. That's a result of people seeing the betrayals of the centrists and the reformists and having an alternative on display, a coherent, compelling, well-organized alternative. And there's no way around that. In most other revolutions, people have been betrayed and demoralized by the reformists and then had nowhere to go. And then the right can just jump on that betrayal and just crush everyone. And that's what we've seen in so many other places. In terms of the defeat of the Russian Revolution, people have dealt with it really well, I thought, especially Clara. Some basic statistics. In 1921, the economy of Russia was one-seventh of what it was in 1913. One-seventh. So you're trying to build socialism in a primitive country, which is one-seventh of its primitiveness when it was a primitive country a few years earlier. It's just impossible. There's not the material basis for it. So you needed Germany, and that didn't come. In terms of, you know, the democracy, how do you have participatory democracy when everyone's literally starving and abandoning the cities and foraging in the countryside? When you call a meeting, there's a meeting every week, the same as there always was. No one's turning up. So you don't have democracy in that context. And I think, I can't remember who wrote this, but someone made a really good and clear argument that made a lot of sense to me. To defeat Stalin, which is what obviously we wanted to do, and what Trotsky fought really hard for, and many others as well, you had to have a whole another revolution in Russia. You had to have a whole another revolution, another workers' revolution to overthrow the bureaucracy. But to have a workers' revolution in conditions of total famine, social breakdown and catastrophe, where the revolutionary left has been massacred, It's just impossible. We wouldn't expect that today in places, you know, where there's been something like that. It just wasn't. It was an objective impossibility, basically, in Russia in the late 1920s for the workers to take over and do what had to be done to stop Stalin taking the power, because they were not supported internationally by successful revolutions. What is the relevance to Australia today? Well, the first thing is, you've got to believe in the power of workers to change the world, and that's got to be your guiding light. That's got to be your strategic orienting vision, that decent, ordinary people have the power to run the world much better than the pricks who run it today. If you believe that, and you think they should do that, then it makes a lot of, it guides you in so many different ways, in so many different levels, from the smallest movement to understanding history and politics around the world. I think Marxism and the kind of Trotsky's arguments also help you understand history, that our time will come. There's a really great quote in his book about 1905, which says, We are as little enamoured of our underground as the drowned man is of the sea bottom. But let us say it straight, we have no choice. Because when you want to change the world, you don't get to set the conditions in which you begin doing that. You have to act in the conditions which you're faced. And in Trotsky's case, that meant, and all the people he worked with, imprisonment. There's another really cool, or not cool, depressing, inspiring statistic. In 1907, there was a congress of the Russian Social Democratic Party. There was 140 people in the room. Trotsky, they did the stats. We sometimes do that for our conferences. They found there was 140 people together that spent 138 and a half years in jail and 148 years in exile. And collectively, they'd been involved in politics for about 900 years. So Trotsky worked out one third of these people's lives was in jail or exile. But then he said, if you spend about one third of your life asleep, so if you take out, you take the two thirds of your life that you're not in prison or in exile, you spend one third of that asleep, and probably other thirds of that time eating and whatever. So really, the amount of politics people are doing is a fraction of the time they're spending in jail and overseas. But thousands of people were prepared to do that because they believed in the cause of working class revolution and human liberation. And I was going to... DT stole my thunder about the mistake. That's the thing he said. Because in the battle with Stalin, he had less credibility because he only joined the revolutionary movement, or the Bolshevik Party, in August of 1917. That's too late. If the Bolshevik Party hadn't been built by the thousands of people, including people like Lenin, Kollontai, and so on, Trotsky could not have had an impact on the Russian Revolution. He benefited from the hard work put in by others, and he admitted that subsequently. We are not the Bolshevik Party, but we are what there is in Australia, so I would encourage comrades not to make that mistake.